Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to New Books in Music, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. My name is Dan Moran. I am thrilled to be here today with Michael Elliott, author of Have a Little Faith, The John Hiatt Story, published in 2021 by Chicago Review Press. Welcome, Michael.
Well, thank you for having me. It's an honor and a privilege to be here.
Well, thanks for coming on the show. As a fellow admirer of John Hiatt, I am so eager to dive into your book and talk about what I've learned from it. But before we get into the book, can you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, I am a freelance writer. I just started that my foray into that about 5 years ago, really, even though I've been writing my whole life. But I was in radio for about 30 years, and that's where I got to interview a lot of great artists from Little Richard to Deborah McClinton and everybody in between. And I would like to say that's where I made contacts and connections, but, you know, not really. It's just that I knew where to go to ask, you know. And then from there, I'm now writing, retired from radio. I have a day job. I work for the Department of Public Safety in North Carolina. But my passion is writing. My passion is music. And why not put them both together? So that's basically about me.
Well, your passion for John Hiatt comes through loud and clear. And, you know, your book is terrific because I think it's difficult to easily categorize because it's part biography. So you get the nuts and bolts of Hiatt's life, but it's also a biography of his recording career. And you really get into like the nuts and bolts of these different albums and what producer he worked with and who brought on this kind of sound and who brought out that kind of sound. And like your book, you know, John Hiatt's a little difficult to categorize too, right? You quote this producer, Matt Wallace, saying, Hiatt didn't fit into any obvious boxes for the sake of easy marketing, right? So that's hard. That's a challenge of writing about Hiatt. Plus you have Elvis Costello's famous line, or at least it's attributed to him, who wrote your introduction, who said, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. So there's all these challenges, right? Anyway, let's do it anyway. Who is John Hiatt and how would you possibly describe his music to someone who's never heard it?
John Hiatt is known mainly as a songwriter. And of course, a songwriter's songwriter is what people usually call him. He was not really a singer-songwriter in the tradition of a Harry Chapin or a Jim Croce or people like that. He's more of a rocker, but he writes songs, he crafts them for other people to sing. That's what he did for many years. And I guess I would describe him as first and foremost a songwriter. But when you bring up that, when you say that to people, they think, oh, he's just going to sit in a room and churn out music, songs all day. But no, he's a performer. If you've ever seen him live, he is one of the most electrifying live performers out there. And still, he's on tour right now as we speak, as a matter of fact. And with the Goners. And he is still smiling and jumping around and having the time of his life, even though he's just shy of his 70th birthday, which is this year. But I would say he's an electrifying live performer. He is a fantastic singer, very underrated in that realm. He is deeply into the blues style, blues and R&B, which he is often not credited for. He gets lumped in now with the Americana crowd, which is fine because that's where they all go now, the old rockers. But he's really a rocker and a blues man at heart, in my opinion.
Yeah, you talk in your book about how that label Americana didn't exist for a long part of his career, and now it's just easy shorthand for trying to describe something that's difficult to describe.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So I did a lot of homework for this interview, and it was great, great fun homework. And I want to get a reaction to a little anecdote. I wanted to fill in the gaps of what I missed for John Hiatt, right? So you know every note inside and out. So I was filling in what I missed. So this is a true story. I'm painting my kid's room, and I have John Hiatt on Spotify, and it's going through his career. And I hear Memphis in the Meantime, okay. And I hear, you know, the Tiki Bar is open, and I got that paint roller going, and I'm doing the cutting, and everything's going on, and I'm singing along. And then this song comes on I never heard before, and it was the song Light of the Burning Sun. And I start listening to it because it's a quiet song. I'm trying to catch the lyrics. And within a minute, I'm just standing there holding my paintbrush, staring at the speaker. And it knocked the wind out of me. And later on, I thought, well, that's John Hiatt. You go from the Tiki Bar to the Light of the Burning Sun, right? Can you comment on that story? What would you say about that story?
Well, that's the extent of human emotion, really. That's all of us, because we have moments where we're joyful, we have moments when we're sad, and listening to a John Hiatt album, those are two different albums, of course, but it'll take you on that journey, no matter what album you put on. There are moments of joy, moments of melancholy, and taking that into effect, yeah, I've had that journey myself, riding down the road listening to him. You know, is it, even in the manner of one song, if he could be having a funny song, and there'll be a line in there that makes you go, whoa, and it's deep. And then on the other hand, it could be a really sad, or you think it's a sad song, and he'll throw a line in there, a curveball, it'll make you just laugh, or at least snicker at the absurdity of it all. And it's a sobering thought. But I mean, that's basically the way I look at it.
That seems why that's why he's so paired so well with Elvis Costello, who wrote the introduction, because they both have that kind of quality, right? Of a phrase that leaps out of nowhere and just kind of grabs you by the lapels.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk about that song, Light of the Burning Sun, a little more, because, you know, after I heard it, I connected it to what I learned from your book. So can you talk about that, the specific connection of that song, and also about Hiatt's growing up in Indianapolis?
The interesting thing, when I was talking to him, interviewing him for the book, he was in the process of recording this album. I had no idea that I had not heard this song until later, you know, after I'd turned the book in, as a matter of fact. And I was like, well, wow, he was really, I caught him at just the perfect time, I believe, because I think he was just in a reflective mood, and he was very open, because John, traditionally, as far as critics and interviewers and people in media are concerned, he's had a reputation of being difficult, or at least very private. And I knew that going in, but I was lucky. I don't know. I just caught him at a good time during the pandemic. Everything was shut down. Everybody was in a reflective mood. Nobody was on the road. And he just so happened to be working with Jerry Douglas at the time at Studio B in Nashville, recording this album, which turned out to be Leftover Feelings. And on that album is The Light of the Burning Sun, which details his childhood, his older brother, Michael, and who committed suicide. And John was 11 years old. Michael was 21 and or 22 when it happened. And, it was devastating to John. It was, as it would be for anybody, but it was a turning point in his life. And it goes deeper in the book about their relationship even further that the song doesn't go into, but, it was a very traumatic situation, and he had to learn to live with that for the rest of his life. And it still affects him. You could tell with this song, it's the first time he addressed it in an album or in song. So, I think he was exercising it in a way, getting it out. And so, which I'm very proud of him for doing. And I'm glad he opened up to me in the book about it as well.
Yeah, it's a powerful song and a powerful part of the book. You also talk about his father, who was literally larger than life, mm-hmm. right? And about him growing up in Indianapolis. What was his childhood like? What was his dad like?
He was a child who had seven, and he was one of seven, and he was Catholic family, and his dad, very overweight, a loving man, although he was difficult, and he was a salesman. They didn't see him much, and when they did get to see him, John doesn't have many happy memories of him, you know, where they bonded, but I think he tried to make the best for his family, because you can imagine being, you know, middle class, living in Indianapolis in the 50s, Broad Ripple, actually, the community, and in the early 50s and up into the 60s, where he was trying to make a life for his family. And he just had his hands full. And of course, he had a weight problem. He had a gambling problem. And there was just all these little secrets running around in the house for extended family. And I go into that a little bit in the book. But his mother and father were, it's not really... He didn't go into any like real trauma between them and him, but he talked about the difficulty growing up in that time.
Yeah. And it all comes up in the song Your Dad Did, which is you end up just like your dad did.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, that's one of those songs where it's funny. And then at the same time, you realize maybe not till after it's over, you go back and listen to it and think, yeah, that's dark, man.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah. That great moment in your life where you realize, oh, I'm just like my father. I'm just like him. Yeah. So that's great. So that part about Hyatt growing up is great because it reminded me, I mean, it's great for a lot of reasons, but one thing that it made me think about were all the biographies I've read about Bob Dylan. I'm sure you've read all the same books, right? Where, you know, you hear about him growing up in Hibbing, Minnesota, and there's this idea, and I wrote this right down in the margins of your book, this idea that you hear something on the radio and like it pulls you spiritually out of this place you're living, right? I remember Bob Dylan says somewhere like, I thought I was born to the wrong parents the first time I heard this music on the radio. And you quote John Hyatt as saying, and here's a quote from your book, "Groundbreaking disc jockeys changed my life." So that's a big statement. So can you talk about the pull of the radio and how it helped Hyatt, you know, change his life and get out of Indianapolis?
I knew where he was coming from with that, because it was the same thing. It happened to me even at, but I loved it so much I jumped in the radio, you know. Dylan and Hyatt are, you know, they have a lot of similarities, the Midwest, the growing up listening to the radio and all that, and wanting to go away. And probably Dylan's a little older, you know, well, at least about 11 years older than John, but still similar trajectories as far as growing up in that, listening to rock and roll and all that, where Dylan had already made a name for himself by the time John really got into rock and roll. But and as a matter of fact, one of the guys he listened to was Bob Dylan. I don't remember if I put it in the book, but there was a point where he was listening to Visions of Johanna over and over. Some interviews he says Visions of Johanna, others he says Sad Eyed Ladies of the Lowland, but either way it's a blonde on blonde track, and he played it for weeks at a time. Did the same thing with Fingertips by Stevie Wonder, to the point where his sisters were concerned for his health, you know. But he got into the folky thing, but yeah, the disc jockeys was WLAC and out of Nashville and Memphis. These were Hoss and Hoss Allen and all these other great disc jockeys that people remember from back in the day. And I'm sure Alan Freed for a certain generation as well. But Indianapolis, as I say in the book, is you're not going to head there to make it. You know, you're not in the music business. You know, you're not going to go to Indy. You're going to go from Indy. You're going to go to New Orleans, to LA, to New York, to Nashville. So when he heard this music, you know, there were some great indie bands. I mean, the McCoys and all these guys, but Rick Derringer and those guys, but they left to make it big elsewhere. And that's what John was seeing in the radio was And as he points out, he was a Catholic kid, and he heard all this, and he would go to church and sing along with all the Latin, and then hear gospel music coming out of Tennessee, and it just blew his mind, you know. And I laughed about that. We talked about that a little bit, because I grew up Southern Baptist in North Carolina, so I grew up with the Southern gospel. Is second nature. It's part of my DNA. But I married a Catholic who I came out of an opposite direction. So
that's a musical mixed marriage.
That's right. But I bring her around to mine pretty easily. It's easy to do that.
Well, that's a great part in the book. You say, you quote, I think John Hyatt said that Indianapolis was the capital of insurance. Right? It's not Music City, right?
No. Now, they get racing. They had the Indy 500, but that's, you know, right. that's not a musical mecca.
And so much of that is lost on readers today, including myself, that whole idea of like at night trying to get the signal in, you know, with the perfect, and hearing a voice at the other end, as opposed to now when you pay your Spotify every month or your Apple Music, and you have this library of music at your fingertips, so I can listen to any John Hyatt song at any moment that I want, and that's great, but you also lose something. You lose that excitement of where is this coming from, and who picked these songs for me?
Right, and that's a whole other show, but yeah, that's the regionality of music is gone, you know, and it does bring us closer together on one hand, but on the other hand, you know, it's so compartmentalized at times. You know, back in those days, you could hear Stevie Wonder and maybe Porter Wagner and then Ray Charles all on the same radio station. Where now if you don't want to, the algorithms will make you listen to nothing but jazz, adult contemporary jazz for schmaltz like Dave Koz and all those guys and never discover anything new unless it sounds exactly like Kenny G or something. So. You know, and I love the satellite radio, but I mean, you not only have classic rock now, you not only have rock, you have classic rock, then in the classic rock, you have vinyl cuts of classic rock, which I don't understand because they're not playing vinyl, but you have a certain subset of a subset of a subset, and that's all they're going to play on that certain station. And I'm like, man, put it all together and let's have some fun with it.
So one of my takeaways from your book, and one of the things that I enjoyed so much about it, was this idea that songwriting is work. Like there's this romantic notion that you sit with your guitar and watch the sunset, and then you actually write the song Lipstick Sunset. But one of the things that you taught me in the book is that there's a lot of sitting in empty rooms with a piano trying to get things right. And Hyatt, I had no idea, had that experience of cranking out songs for his day job, right? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, he got a job at Tree Publishing. It's quite a funny thing because he grew up listening to the radio, you know, and he was he said, okay, I'm going to be a musician, I'm going to be a rock star, I'm going to go sing for people, or a folk star, or however he wanted to do it. And he meets this guy Bob Frank, and Bob Frank is just one of these troubadour guys, folk singer, great dude, and a fantastic self-titled album that came out in 72, sorry, and so. He meets John. He says, "Yeah, I'm." This is before his album came out, but he said, "I've got a deal with Tree Publishing where they pay me this certain amount of money, just a little pittance, but for me to write songs, and I get it every week." And he said, "You get paid to just write songs?" And he didn't know that. So he said, "Well, I can do that." And so. So he goes up to he meets all these publishing companies up and down the street, you know, in Nashville, and finally he hits Tree Publishing last. He said he saved that for last before he decided to give up, and they liked his stuff, and so he sits up shop there, and he sits in a little room, and it's basically a 9-to-5 gig. He has and John Hyatt cannot read or write music. In the traditional sense. So what he did was he sat down with a tape recorder or reel to reel and performed just with his guitar and just came up with these songs all day, every day. And then I believe it was Buddy Kilman. He said that Hyatt had boxes and boxes of these songs. And Denny Bruce tells me in the book that, you know, he went through every one of them. And he was just writing for people. As I said earlier, it was a craft, it was a job. And he was writing in the style of these people that he knew had hits. And he said, okay, well, I'll write a song like this, you know, and like that. And so it was, you know, people talk about authenticity and all this stuff, but it was a living, and that's what all songwriters did. And so, well, we're going to write a song for this person or that person, and he's going to sound like Randy Newman on one song. He may sound like Three Dog Night on the other. They liked it so much they picked up a song of his. He didn't even pitch it to them. They just heard it and decided they wanted to record it.
And that was Sure As I'm Sitting Here, right?
Right, yeah. And then Three Dog Night, when people – they had such pull that, you know, they were champions of great songwriters, from Laura Nero to Hoyt Axton and all these people. So when they pulled a John Hiatt song out of the hat, people took notice. They said, well, look at this guy, you know?
So you talk about, you know, Bonnie Raitt's, famous covers of his, and him with Roseanne Cash later on in the book. But the centerpiece of your book, and you would kind of allude to it in the beginning, and you kind of come off it. If the book has a plot, the climax of it, I would say, is the recording of Bring the Family and about making that album, right? So you contend, you mentioned more than once, that's kind of that's like the keystone of his career. You don't say it's his best album or worst, because you give him a lot of credit for trying a lot of different kind of sounds, right? But you get the feeling as a reader, okay, if Michael Elliott can say, listen, you get one album by John Hiatt, you won't Bring the Family, right? So talk to me about what it is about that album that you think is so compelling, like artistically, and so important in Hiatt's story.
He spent his career up to that point searching for a sound that he thought people wanted to hear. In my opinion, his first two albums were sort of a freak folk, mid-70s singer-songwriter folk thing. And then he goes off into the new wave, for lack of a better term, but it was the Elvis Costello era, you know, and they wanted him to be the American Elvis. And, but he was taken from that, the stiff record sound, you know. He loved the Nick Lowe produced stuff coming out of England at the time. So he latched onto that. And then, you know, I believe it was by the time, of course, there's the whole arc of him getting sober and stuff, and his wife, his second wife committing suicide. It helped him straighten up, and I think it was that clarity of mind where he realized that he needs to stop writing for, I don't want to say writing for other people, but just writing what he thinks people want to hear, and just digging deep and writing what he wants to say. And without now he'd been, you know, kind of snarky and you know, he'd had that Elvis Costello vibe too, you know, and, the smirk on his face while he's doing, you know, slug line and all these things. Here's where he dug deep and looked at himself, and the centerpiece of that Bring the Family is Have a Little Faith in Me. And I really didn't think about it. Maybe it was obvious to some people, but I didn't think about it till I talked to him, where he said that when he was writing that song, he was actually thinking about himself, and he was singing to himself about that. And I thought, well, that's pretty doggone profound. So he was trying to convince himself to have faith in himself that he would be there. Because and it's poignant, because if you don't want to help yourself, you're not ever going to get help, you know. And so he had, that was him convincing himself. And so that album runs the gamut of you got your humor with Memphis in the Meantime, but at the same time, it's a need to escape the humdrum of daily life. You got the dark night of the soul and Alone in the Dark. Then you got the excitement of new love with a couple of songs. And then you got at the same time, you're regretting the suicide of his wife. He regrets the relationship, how it turned out, you know, with maybe Lipstick Sunset and Tip of My Tongue. So, and then he talks about his dad, and your dad did, like we talked about, but it's, and is complete, an amazing, to me, the greatest moment on the album is Stood Up, and where he confronts his sobriety and his past, you know, and his first wife even in that song. But it's just a tour de force, as they say, to use an overused cliche. But It definitely is. And I think that is a true masterpiece that came out at the time when America was kind of when the music industry was moving a little toward roots rock because of the John Mellencamps and all that. You know, that was the same year that Lonesome Jubilee came out. So they were but at the same time, it was still a lot of slickness in on radio, and this was really, really raw and organic, recorded in 4 days with no overdubs, you know, with an amazing band. So it's just, yeah, that's where you start to me.
Even the cover is authentic. The photo. Now you tell a story in the book about the original cover, right? And how they opted for a different cover of just Hyatt's face. Can you tell that story?
Yeah, the UK version had a very strange picture that they still don't know the exact origin of it, but it was a mother and father. It's an old family, looks like an old family portrait from the 19th century. But when you look a little closer, you see that the three kids in the picture are ventriloquist dummies. Or marionettes, very creepy and but hilarious at the same time. So it's quite dry and tongue in cheek. But I think A&M for the States that was put out on Demon Records, very closely linked with Costello and the guys. But in the States, you know, A&M is like, what is this? No, so let's go with the old tried and true artist headshot. But I will say that headshot is quite fascinating. It's just nothing but a dark background and the expression on his face I found it very captivating because it's like he's I get from that picture on the cover of Bring the Family that he's not resigned, but it's like, well, this has been my life and this is where I am now.
Yeah.
And
this is what I got at this point.
Yeah. It's an acceptance and I love that. It's like, take it or leave it. Here I am.
You know? Yeah. So, you know, I want to jump ahead to something you said before about him confronting his sobriety. So part of his biography, which you cover in the book, is his alcoholism, his recovery. You have some drug abuse in there as well, but I want to get your reaction to a quote from your book. This is from Have a Little Faith, quote, "When you ask an addict about his particular rock bottom, it's not always clear cut. They all have their own process. Sometimes it's spiritual. Sometimes it's a legal matter that snaps them out of it. For John, it was a drive through the deep South in the company of a Dutch woman." Can you talk about that?
On the album Leftover Feelings, again, I did not know he was doing this in parallel to our conversations, but there's a song called Mississippi Phone Booth, and he actually recounts that without giving it all away, which is what great songwriters do. He took this girl. He met this girl over he had been touring the Netherlands, and where he's a huge following over there. And so while he was there, he met this little Dutch girl, and unfortunately, that's all she's known as. But, you know, not to dehumanize her in any way, but it's all anybody ever knew her as, you know, Nick Lowe, everybody. But, and no names were given, which I understand for obvious reasons. But he, in his drunken state of mind or in his messed up state of mind, he decided that the best way to reconcile his marriage to Isabella, his second wife, is to have an affair or not really to have an affair, but to bring the girl he was having an affair with over to America from the Netherlands. And he said he still couldn't make sense of why he did that now looking back. But he took her on a drive in the deep South to show her, you know, I guess he was being like the cool guy. Look at all this authentic Southern land and this is what I sing about, you know, and all this type of thing. And this is where roots of America, I can hear him now, you know, the roots of the blues come from here, baby, you know, and all this stuff, driving in his Camaro and all that. And just something happened there. He had some cocaine and some vodka and all this stuff, and they just ran out or just wouldn't work anymore. And he found himself in the middle of the night at a phone booth at some service station in Mississippi, and he decided to call his ex-wife and try to get back together right there. And that was his rock bottom, and that's what turned his life around. And he brought the girl back to Nashville and put her on a plane, and then he tried to go back to the West Coast to make up with Isabella.
So let me do a side question, and then we'll get back to John Hyatt. And I want to ask you this because you've talked to a lot of people in the music industry. You've been in it. It's your passion. You've met a lot of people. So a lot of theories about this. And I don't even know if they hold up, but I want to get your take on this. Is there a connection between incredibly talented people like Hyatt and like abusive alcohol or abusive drugs? Because it would have just been a Jerry Garcia's 80th birthday, right? And we think of some people get clean, like Trey Anastasio. I'm thinking of Eric Clapton, John Hyatt himself, and some sadly do not, right? So is there any connection? People have all kinds of theories of that for pop psychology, but is there a connection or is that just an illusion?
I will say this, one of the things that I really love about John's story and that I want to make clear from this book, and I hope I made clear, is that there's a big myth about the suffering artist, that the fact that you have to be drunk and high and also miserable to make great art, and what John proved in his journey is the fact that he cleaned up and then he became an amazing singer-songwriter. He was already great, but his most critically lauded phase came after he cleaned up and started being straight with himself and with the listeners. And people started identifying with him the more he sung about himself. And his own experiences, because what is personal is universal. I think he spent his first many albums looking outward and trying to see how he could be clever. But just looking inward and being true to himself is what made him. And doing it through a clear mind, I can tell you from. And it's funny you asked that question because I went through it myself. I abused alcohol up until. As a matter of fact, it's been 10 years this past July 4th, 2012 is when I drank my last drop. So after that, my life and my career and all that, I got a book to show from there. and I would never have been able to do it 10 years ago or so, great things can happen. I tell you exactly what it is. In my opinion, I think it's the pressure of being in the business of rock music, and probably not now as much as it used to be. But I do know, I thought about when John first got sober. Nick Lowe was talking about it, how they would play gigs and stuff, and they'd be in these bars, and all of them are still. Nick would try, quote unquote, to stop drinking at the time, but he's still every now and then. But it's all around you. And so you can't help but, if you can't beat them, join them type of thing. So when you stop drinking, as me as a former DJ, and I also DJed, and I was also in local bands and stuff, I was a singer. And so when you're in that situation, you're in around it in bars where people are doing it, and our culture is so alcohol driven. It's you can't escape it. So you've got to be extremely strong. Your will's got to be, you've got to say, no, I don't want it. And then you have to put up with people who want you to explain why you're not drinking. I think I saw this thing the other day where it said alcohol is the only drug you have to explain why you're not using it, So. Yeah, I think it's just the peer pressure and the feeling that you have to suffer for your art, or it'll find you find some new creative outlets. But yeah, it's not true.
That story you just told also applies because you talked to Bonnie Raitt, because you have Bonnie Raitt tells that story in your book as well, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's right. She was around that time. It was the mid to late 80s is when everybody started realizing in their own way, on their own terms. It was Hyatt and then Bonnie Raitt, Paul Barrere of Little Feet, who had seen his bandmate
Lowell George
die prematurely. And then you had Stevie Ray Vaughan, who unfortunately met his demise in a different way later, but he cleaned up. And you had all these people that were in a nucleus that it was just a great. Peer pressure can go the other way too. You could do great things, and so that's what was happening there. The snowball of sobriety was happening. And so I think, and then it's funny, Bonnie Raitt does the same thing. Nick of time, clean and sober. Her career record, and she just started getting bigger and bigger after that.
Yeah. So you've mentioned before about meeting Hyatt, who you refer to as John, right? In the notes, you say you interviewed him three times in October of 2020. So what was it? What was he like? What was he like when you interviewed
him? He was amazingly warm and welcoming. Only one time where we at the end of the second interview, I believe he was very tired and grateful to be over the interview. But even then, he was just gracious as he could be. So all three times, and then his wife Nancy, she was just as sweet as she could be. Nancy and I both, me being from North Carolina. It's funny. There were a couple of instances. She's one of them when they picked up the phone and I said, "Hi, I'm Nancy. I'm Michael Elliott." And she said, "You are?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, okay. I like your voice." She said, "I thought you were in New York or something." I said, no, ma'am. I'm from right here where you are." I don't know if that helped the interview or not, but and Bonnie Raitt even said, she said, it's just at the end of our interview, she said, it's just good to hear a good old Southern voice for a change. I'm living out here in LA. I don't ever hear that.
Did John Hyatt put up any kind of like self-deprecating kind of like, not resistance, but something like, what are you writing a book for about me? I'm just like, 'cause he comes across as that kind of self-effacing guy.
He was very humble, and he kept, I had to, sometimes I had to pull some things from him but once I did, he just opened up, and he was very humble about it. I will say, I got to give props to Ken Levitin, who, his manager, was just invaluable in helping me, with John, with access to John. And I don't know, there was, I don't know what happened, but, I guess I did I said the right stuff, but, I'm grateful for all the help he gave me. And, it's funny, I had interviewed Sonny Landreth and quite a few folks, players, Roseanne Cash and all those people before I got to John. And Ken finally, he emailed me because I had been trying to get John the whole time. And my publisher had said, you don't need to have an interview with John in order for us to publish this book. It's fine. And I thought, well, I can't do that. I got to have, I've read some great books where they don't have participation. I've read some great biographies that way, but that's not how I wanted to play it, but I didn't know what I was going to do for a while. And then one morning on a Sunday morning, now I get an email at 7:30, 8:30 in the morning. And it's my time. This is from Nashville, which is an hour behind. And it was Ken Levitin saying, "I hear you're writing a book about my client. Tell me more." And I thought, well, this guy's earning his pay.
Well, it's great. They always say never meet your heroes, but it sounds like you met John Hyatt and you weren't disappointed.
Everybody in this process has been just wonderful. Yeah. Great to work with. And there were a couple that turned me down, and that's fine. I mean, but I think my batting average, I'm very proud of.
And one stylistic strength of your book, I think, is that you have many paragraphs in the book where you say, you have a quotation and you say, "Hyatt explains," or you're talking about, "Ray Cooter explains," or Raitt explains, and you let the people talk. You don't try to psychoanalyze them. And that's what turned me to your notes page. And I said, wow, this guy did his homework of all these interviews.
Yeah. I really wanted them to say it in their own words. I really wanted this book to be not your, well, I don't want to say you're not your typical biography, because I went back and did it in chronological order and everything. But what I really wanted to do, I wanted to go in and do it like a fan. I didn't want to be too studious. I didn't want to be too quotey on one hand. But on the other hand, I did want to let them speak. I didn't want to overanalyze things. But at the same time, I wanted to spend a lot of time talking about the music. I think a lot of times when in these biographies that I read, I get a lot of stuff about the person, but I don't get enough about the music, which is why
reading it in the first place.
Yeah. I might as well be reading about, you know, a Roman emperor. I mean, it's just, I want to know what made them want to make this music, and I want to read about the music, because I love reading about music. Everybody from Peter Guralnick and to Grail Marcus, and so these are the heroes of the genre. But I can only wish to be up there. It's funny, a little side story. Speaking of Guralnick, I sent him an email just because by this time I was looking, seeing if anybody wanted to participate, or maybe, you send out little suggestions for, or questions about if you want a blurb for the book, So by this point, I'm like, brave. I'm like, why not send Peter Guralnick an email me back? And he said, good luck with your book. I don't blurb anymore. And for obvious reasons, everybody's probably asking him that, but he was just as gracious as he could be. And I can't remember what, but he gave me a little Abner reference in there. And I thought, damn, Peter Guralnick sends me an email and gives me a little Abner reference. You can't beat that.
Well, you just reminded me of something else. Peter Guralnick and Grail Marcus have both written about Elvis. And in the book, you talk about John Hyatt's, worship of Elvis. And you have that great scene where he learns that Elvis has died. Can you tell that story and about the impact Elvis had on Hyatt?
Yeah, Elvis is a central character in Hyatt's story. And as far as his influence, most everybody in his generation, it's either the Elvis or Beatles. It's either Elvis or the Beatles, and a little combination of both in most of us. But with Elvis, he had been. I think the deep connection with Elvis comes also from the fact that his childhood and his fact that he had a loving mother, Elvis did, and their relationship. And I think John felt a lot of times he felt alone when his brother, he looked up to him. This is me being a cheap psychoanalyst here at this moment, but I think he looked up to his brother so much. And when his brother died, that's where he got all his music. All his love of music came from him, Michael. And when Michael died, he didn't have that anymore. And I think probably Elvis may have been some kind of link to that. And he felt that Elvis was probably lonely because he, even though he was surrounded by an amazing entourage of people from the Memphis Mafia and everyone in the world wanting, he probably felt very alone. And I think John felt that in him. So when Elvis died, he heard it on the radio, and he said he pulled over on the side of the road, and it was just some cows watching him cry. But it's typical John. He's telling you a sad story, making you laugh at the same time. So Riding with the King comes from that, and he's always had a little bit of Tennessee Plates, he's just always had a little bit of Elvis fascination, which makes, of course, his music even better.
I love this section in your book about Little Village, which is, that story has such a great arc. I remember when the Little Village album came out. I remember thinking how funny the song Solar Sex Panel was. Tell us about this would-be supergroup of Little Village and how things played out with it, because I think it's got a great beginning, middle, and an end. It's such a great representative story about the music industry.
I never thought of it that way, but I guess it does. I guess you can't talk about Little Village without talking about Lenny Waronker, who is a Svengali of the music industry, which is quite apropos since recently Mo Austin passed away. He was 95 years old, and he was like the musical guru of Warner Brothers Records, well, in its heyday, and Lenny Waronker was like right there with him, and Waronker was in charge of he Reprise and all these great labels under the Warner umbrella, and he he grew up with Randy Newman, you know, and they were just buddies, and he got him on Warner Brothers and who played guitar for Randy Newman on his first, but Ry Cooter. And so Ry Cooter was on Warner Brothers because of Lenny. And so they were all buddy buddies. And as the years go past, Lenny loves the Traveling Wilburys, and he wanted a super group for his label. And he looks out at Ry, and then he sees, he's at the Bring the Family thing had happened, and he thought, well, we got our own right here, got Jim Keltner does the drums for the Wilburys. So he and Ry are like joined at the hip, and so why not bring Hyatt and Lowe back into the fold, because they had worked together before. And so it all just came to Little Village. The issue with Little Village, of course, was where Bring the Family was done in 4 days, under the direction, more or less, of John Hyatt and John Shalhoub, who was the producer. This Little Village was more of a quote-unquote collaborative effort, where it was everybody kind of did the songwriting all together, and they had, as in Nick Lowe's words, unlimited time and unlimited money. And, I guess, as it's been said before, one thing I believe in is there's nothing better than pressure for strong creativity. If you can give somebody all the time in the world
and all the money, a budget can, the constraints of a budget can force people to be more creative as well.
Absolutely. Yes. And within that framework of a short time period and no money. But now, that being said, it does have some great moments. I had it on just last night, as a matter of fact. And there are some times I can listen to it and it hits right. There are other times I listen to it and the parts of it is just, But I think it had so much potential. It is a cute little album, but it had so much hype around it. It could not live, and it was following Bring the Family, so everybody was like, okay, show us Bring the Family too. And that's not what happened. And it's just, it was set up to be a disappointment in a way.
Yeah. Everybody wants a sequel, and you don't always get Godfather 2.
No, sometimes you get Godfather 3.
Exactly. Right. So I want to end by talking about how you end the book. So, you could have ended this story at many different spots, and you ended by talking about Dolly Parton's 2020 cover of Hyatt's Have a Little Faith. And here's what you say. This is the very end of the book, and I want to read this to you and get your reaction to it, because you could have ended this book in 100 different ways. Here's how you do it. This is from your book. Quote, "The ultimate gift is when you take what you've learned and pass it on, making someone else's life better. He's done that for me, and since you've read this far, he's most likely done it for you too." Can you talk about your choice of words there?
I believe that when you're put on this earth to give, if you're given a talent, not to get too, spiritual, but if you're given a talent, I believe it's the, your obligation to pass it on. And in doing that, you can make people's lives better. And John, his music has touched me in many ways. And that Bring the Family album in particular made me, even though when I first heard it when I was 17 years old, which was a strange time for a strange album for a 17-year-old to embrace as much as he has. But it's still as relevant now, if not more so than it was then. And it's made me want to be a better person. So that's a doggone amazing piece of art. And I hope that, from what I've talked with other people, a lot of people share that same sentiment. So the fact that that song, Have a Little Faith, is still making differences in people's lives. Dolly Parton loved it so much. She joined this group and did basically a techno version of it. The spirit of the song remains. So, and I think it's fantastic that he's still as relevant as he is now than he was then.
Thanks. And it was, and your book is fantastic as well. So I just got to say, it was great talking to you today. Have a little faith. The John Hyatt story is available everywhere. It's published by the Chicago Review Press. It's a great read. It's a book that sent me back over and over to Hyatt. I had like this John Hyatt renaissance going on here in my house. For that, I have to thank you for sharing your, you know, like your enthusiasm kind of caught on to me. And the story of every album, I found myself, oh, let me listen to that today. And I was binging John Hyatt, but what a great thing to be able to do. So I heartily encourage the book to everybody. I really enjoyed reading it. Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you, and I appreciate the kind words. And it's coming out in paperback as well. So if you're more of a paperback person, then grab it up.
Great. Thank you so much, Michael.
You too.
Michael Elliott, everybody. Thanks.